Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Lisa Donovan, author of this, her first novel, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, published this month by Penguin. Lisa's first, a great chef, and a James Beard award-winning essayist. And she's helped establish some of the South's most important kitchens, especially with regard to her pastry. And as we were talking about, if you read more about Lisa, check out her hand pies. she's also been a featured speaker at the renowned MAD Symposium and has written for Food and Wine and lots of other periodicals. So Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger is a book, about food, but it's also a book about hunger, not necessarily hunger in the usual sense, but hunger for something else, which we'll talk about. When you care about food more than fame, you may get both, as Lisa has. But along the way, you may get stepped on, you may get angry, you may even get sick physically, mentally, emotionally. So with candor, true candor, emotion and fervor, as well as humor, Lisa's written a memoir that enlightens and teaches as well as renews our passion for food, and as I said, especially pastry. So welcome, Lisa, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for such a generous introduction. That was very nice. Thank you.
So I always like to start with the cover, and this is a really cool cover to the book. And it almost looks like, maybe, and I guess you tried, it almost looks like a Vermeer Dutch painting. It has that feel about it. So did you get a chance to vet it or did you pick it? How did it come about?
Yes and yes and yes. I was actually a bit of a stubborn cuss about the cover. It was one of the things that Penguin Press and I have had this really amazing relationship, and they have been so, they have really stood behind me on every decision, and I really didn't want to be on the cover. And they kept saying, you really need to be on the cover. And I couldn't quite wrap my head around why I needed to be on the cover, because so much of this book was about, we're having a big storm. So you'll probably hear, it's a great, in the South, we get these beautiful summer storms and we're getting one right now. It's amazing. But you'll probably hear some, Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
We kind of went toe-to-toe a little bit, and I said, look, so much of this book is about, doing away with this celebrity chef culture, and this sort of bro culture and this sort of idea of, like, you know, a man standing on the cover of his book looking really tough and looking really, it's just all ego. And I said, I really am trying to sort of break this chasm of chef and ego and celebrity culture. And I didn't necessarily want to be on the cover because I felt like it was an opportunity to also, bring in an artist and maybe do a collage or a painting of some sort. But they found an old photo taken by one of my best friends who happens to be one of the country's finest photographers named Eva Saad. And there she is. And they got with Eve and I got to talk it out with Eve, and I said, look, okay, I want to be anonymous. I want this to look timeless. I want it to look like a painting, and she nailed it. She just nailed it, so.
Yeah, the sepia tone, and like I said, the way you're turned, it looks just like that Vermeer picture of the girl turn. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely, and you know what? You know, I have this independent bookstore, and as many times as people can say to me, you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into that bookstore judges a book by its cover.
That's true.
100%. Unless they know what they're looking for. But if they're just browsing, that's what they see. And this kind of cover really attracts. So
good. That's
good.
Great.
Job.
Hopefully they get to the middle of the book and they're just as, just as inspired or impressed.
Yeah. I think they will be. And then the second thing I like to talk about is the epigraph. And this one touches home for me because it's from American Girl. And I was in Gainesville, Florida for 30 years, so I kind of knew Tom Petty just from passing him and going to this bar called Dubs. But what I wanted to know, and I think I know the answer, is I assume you are that American girl.
You know, it's funny. I had a couple of epigraphs that I was going between. One of them was an Ursula Le Guin quote that was really beautiful and heady and about women telling their stories and felt really succinct with the messaging of the book. And then I just sort of had this moment, you know, where I was sort of thinking about the more plain sort of idea behind this book. And so much of the plain language of this book can just be sort of distilled into those, you know, that one sentence, which is, there's this idea for women, for girls that grew up at a certain time as American humans, where, you know, it's the land of opportunity, it's the land of everything, and we were sort of told and taught. So much of our conditioning was this almost on a loop. You can do and be anything you want to do and be. You can. You know, the world is for you. You know, the feminism sort of created this supposed space where we could go out there and truly be on equal footing. And it was all a lie. You know, in so many ways, it was, we actually were the ones that had to go in and do the dismantling. It was just an opportunity to go do more. That, you know, it was setting the stage to actually do the work. And while I'm grateful for these sort of early, of course, you know, all women are grateful for the people that come before them and that set the stage. But you realize on some level that, you know, how little that the bra burning feminists actually provided as far as a space where we could just show up and work the way that white men get to work, and how little that incorporated Black women, and how little that incorporated Indian women, and how little that incorporated Native women, and how little that incorporated so many other women who we are standing next to, you know. So there was, for me, that was a really succinct way of just talking about the promise of something and how we still had to go and kind of create, you know, the reality of that promise for ourselves. So.
Well, okay. I'm an old white male. So early on in the book, playing devil's advocate, you talk about these millionaire guys. Maybe they don't even ever step into the restaurant. They want you being open. They want the food coming out. They want a 2-hour waiting list. They want reservations a month in advance. All these things that they want. What's wrong with wanting that?
Well, what's wrong with wanting that? There's nothing wrong with wanting that. And that's not really sort of the perspective. The perspective is wanting that and understanding how to do that in a way that not only values, but honors the life and sustainability of your model for the working class. And understanding, you know, I think we're in a moment right now where we're starting to understand who is this country, and it is the working class, it is workers, it is people who wash dishes 20 hours a day, it is people who take out the trash, it is people who cut vegetables to serve to you so that you don't have to cook at home. We're sort of getting a real glimpse into who we consider essential workers in this country outside of our medical field and soldiers and our military. We're really getting an understanding of who actually keeps our communities going. And those are so often the people that have to have 4 or 5 jobs just to survive, because these people with big money come in and spend their money on PR companies instead of taking care of their workers that provide the resources to have a restaurant. So, you know, I think my biggest beef with these people that come in with all of this money and decide they want to make an empire out of something as simple and as basic as food, what you're really talking about is a real... It's you know, you can start to think about it in a caste system and who actually, you know, is providing the work and the product and the services. And those are the same people that are going to immediately suffer when restaurants can't function anymore, right? You know, the restaurant groups that were spending $10,000 a month on, you know, a PR company to make them, you know, get into the Vogue interior catalog, You know, that should have been for a family, a worker who has a family who's making $12 an hour, that, you know, and it feels like a really hard time to be having a conversation about restaurants in general, because everyone is struggling. But it's also an opportunity to say that the restaurants and chefs who are doing it right, and there are plenty, thank goodness, they're the ones that are suffering in this moment. And so I think it's an opportunity for us to really talk about, you know, the real class disparity that we're experiencing, and who, you know, who provides the real important services that this country runs on, and who, and those are the people that are suffering the most. And so, and that was true before the pandemic. You know, that was true. So it's not a problem that people want to have their money make more money. That's capitalism. And there's, I don't know if you heard that. It's a really good storm. But there's a real opportunity to just have a conversation about how we treat our working class in this country. And I think that's the bottom line. It starts from the people who have the best.
Yeah, and I understand it completely. And as I said, I was playing devil's advocate. In fact, and we're talking about money and being taken care of in the sense both fiscally and reasonably, and good hours, appreciation, and all that. But you have a quote that says, be invisible, be whiter, be prettier, don't take up any space, stupid, stupid, stupid. And you get, I mean, you are angry. There's no question about it, because you can tell from the first couple of pages that you are. So that's another aspect of it. It's not just, you know, compensating people or even giving them good hours. It's the idea of, you know, the people I hate are like, when I go to a restaurant and if I'm with a couple like that, they treat the server as if they aren't as important or they aren't as good as them, you know, I'm never going to go out with them. Everybody's the same. And I guess that's kind of your message, but your industry is one of the worst, seems to me, in that way.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, that quote in particular about be whiter, be prettier, I think was a bigger conversation about how women have to spend a lot of their time and energy undoing a lot of messaging from, you know, from their family, from their communities, from, you know, it's a little thing called internalized misogyny, and we all carry it. And a lot of women, you know, spend a lot of their adult life really trying to figure out how to leave it behind so that they can maneuver, you know, that they can just go straight into the world that they deserve to live in without having to maneuver this messaging and this attempted conditioning of who, what our, where our value lies. And that seems like a conversation we should, you know, we should have been able to stop having years ago, but the reality is it's still very externalized. It's not even just a messaging I'm carrying around with me. It's also a messaging I meet, you know, in many, many, many ways, shapes, and forms outside of my own sort of, you know, thought processes about what I deserve and what I don't deserve. And so, you know, I think there's an arc here that I was trying to sort of connect between my experiences and sort of this, you know, I think there's this question going around of like, what radicalized you? And I think the restaurant industry is, you know, what officially sort of radicalized me about workers' rights and about how we treat the people that, you know, basically carry the weight of this country on their backs. And that, you know, that conversation coupled with my own personal sort of journey with why I make or previously had made exemptions for people that condone, you know, things that keep people down and oppress people is something I really also wanted to address, because I think a lot of this work is us addressing it with ourselves as well. So,
yeah. And the other thing is, you know, I've been following your Twitter account, you know, and this, okay, I don't know if you want to talk about it in this context, but because we're trying to sell your book, but, you know, what your comments about Kamala Harris and how happy you are that she was chosen by Biden. what you're saying about radicalization kind of goes to that. And so I'm starting out with cooking and with your Nana and things like that. But at the same time, well, we learn a lot about you, some of which is a little off, and we can talk about that too. But okay. So how did you, okay, what about your political position? I mean, you said you become radicalized, and there was a process during which that happened. And now it ends up here where you are, and you're fighting for a cause. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit, even from your childhood, how that began and how it's become stronger and stronger, because it is very strong.
I want to make it really clear, because of the sort of temperance or lack thereof of the moment, of what I mean by radicalization. I mean, for me, a personal radicalization of my own spirit and of my own expectations in the world. And I don't consider myself all that politically radical. I think whenever I, am excited about someone like Kamala Harris, it is because I think that she speaks to a better version of our country than we have right now. And I don't think that's radical at all. I think that that is another way of sort of paying attention to the things that make this country work instead of the things that destroy this country, which is, I believe, squarely where we are right now. And so that my enthusiasm for, you know, for her being our hopeful next vice president goes beyond sort of this idea that I think that in our communities, we should be thinking more clearly about the people that, that build those communities and keep those communities afloat, and not just the top down, but the bottom up. And, I do think that part of my upbringing of realizing how hard that was for my grandmother, who was a brown woman in this world, how much erasure that we have had in our family has created an anger in me of the loss I feel. There is a real anger there because she was, the real anger comes from this realization. You know, it's twofold. I'm very sad and heartbroken that I've lost all of these stories from her and all of this language and all of her culture, because in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s, and she died in 1987, that moment in the history of America was one where she truly, truly believed that her brownness and her Spanish tongue was a hindrance and a pain that she had to bury every day, and she hid from us. And the real anger comes from the fact that she was right, because if I were a woman right now who was as brown as she was and who spoke Spanish and who lived by her Catholic and her Mexican traditions, you bet your ass I would never have excelled in the kitchen the way I excelled, because my skin is my dad's color, and because I speak perfect English, and because I don't have an accent. You bet your ass I would never have ever been asked by famous people to cook very fancy meals. I may have, but I would have been a maid. I would never have been a celebrity chef. And there's some real truth to understanding that I'm so hurt by the loss of her and her culture, but that she also wasn't wrong. And that's where the anger, that's where the hurt turns to anger, because unfortunately she saw something and knew something. And as much as I want the parts of her that felt like the most sincere reflections of her, I have to live with the fact that she knew something very heartbreaking about this country all those years ago. And so it's this sort of bifurcated truth of understanding what she meant, and as much as I don't like it, what my reality has been. And so there is an anger there that comes from that truth.
There's a surprise for me, because in my bookstore, after George Floyd, and especially after Rayshard Brooks, you know, because it was like, this is an incident that happened over 45 minutes in HDTV, and why cops with body cams do this, I don't know. And plus Wendy's had the cameras too. And so afterwards I said, yeah, I'm sick of this. So I put a Black Lives Matter sign on my window, and I have a sheet that says, say their names with all the names, and I put it in each bag as people leave the bookstore. And then I get these emails, and I got this horrible message on my answering machine saying they drove by to get some coffee and books, and they saw that sign, and they go, we can never come to your bookstore again, and we hope that your sales are disastrously low. Mm-hmm. I sent it to my brother, and he just responded, ugly mind. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I can't comprehend the thought process that goes behind that. And luckily, everyone in my family has the same political views as me. Otherwise, it would be a real mess.
I know that. I know that experience.
And talking about your Nana, you know, that's the thing that I'm looking at right now, like the recipe for masa. You know, it's like a letter from her. It's a recipe and tells you how to make it, but it's also like a letter.
Yeah.
Must be more poignant now. She's still talking to you, you know? Isn't that cool?
It's incredible. And, you know, the things that, you know, no matter, you know, she did speak to me in Spanish and she did tell me stories in some ways about, but they were all done in very deep privacy. And the thing about her culture and her beliefs that did stick wholly, that are, you know, seem very steeped in this sort of Mexican Catholic tradition of her upbringing, is this mysticism that she will always be around me. And that is a very deep, like she talks to me in all the ways, not just her recipes, but her recipes are very rich. You know, that's how she spoke. How she wrote was how she spoke. And it's a real gift, because I can hear her even all these years later. I can really hear her voice, even though I was 10 when she died. You know, it's one of the strongest voices in my head. So
I like the way in the recipe she says, maybe you don't want to, it's okay if you don't want to do it this way.
Yeah.
This is the way, yeah, it's the way I do it, but it's okay if you don't want to. I mean, it's wonderful.
My mom, baby, and every other line, and it's really sweet.
It was really, you know, I really like that a lot. Well, let's go to the kitchen. I mean, you talked at the beginning about the covers of books with Anthony Bourdain is the first thing that comes to mind. May he rest in peace. But still, I guess, you know, he tells you what the kitchen is like. You tell me what the kitchen is like he does.
Well, it depends on which kitchen. The kitchen that I live in now, you know, the kitchen that I sort of decided was the space I wanted to continue working in, is one of, you know, collaboration and kindness and thoughtfulness. And I don't mean thoughtfulness in so much as I mean like, I do mean from one person to another, but thoughtfulness in that you're considering every move and every idea and every, you know, thoughtfulness in every moment is a really important thing. And I have worked in kitchens like that before that are in, you know, professional kitchens, or restaurant kitchens, I guess would be the better way of putting it. But, you know, you don't get to control the variables. Sometimes I have a team that works with me whenever I have to do a bigger event, or if I'm cooking, you know, if I'm doing a private thing or a commissioned thing or a consulting thing. And those kitchens are typically, I don't only work with women. I have some men that I occasionally will hire here and there to come work with me. And there's a specific generosity I think that I look for in cooks that I think is really apparent in most cooks that I think are out there. Cooks are a really generous breed of people, you know, that's why we come to cooking. We we really love to give of ourselves and be really present in the act of cooking and be present in the act of sharing a conversation with a person. And I think I just look for that generosity and sort of, I don't even look for cooking skills necessarily, because I feel like there's always something in the kitchen that someone can do, you know? And that's, I think there's something really special about that. It is, I think I've surprised some cooks because I'm so open to change in a way that I was never able to be in a restaurant kitchen, because you have to keep things so rigid to, you know, to make sure that, you know, I can remember at the high times at Husk, whenever things were really intense, I would get so frustrated and angry if anyone would deviate from a recipe. There was never room for, you know, not spontaneity necessarily, but improvisation. There was never room for, you know, I didn't have the butter I needed, so I used this. Well, you need to just get the butter you need. Like in a restaurant, everything has to be consistent. That's what you look for. Consistency is so important. And whenever I'm doing these, there's so, whenever now, you know, in anything that I'm running now, there's room for conversation about what do we have, what can we do. And I think it surprises some cooks that I want their opinions so readily, and that I'll take their suggestions, which is also, you know, I think not necessarily, I think in some good kitchens it exists, but when you're working in such a fast-paced, high volume kitchen, there's not a whole lot of room for that kind of togetherness, you know. And I think that's really special, and I'm really glad for it. I'm really glad that now whenever I have to be in a kitchen with 10 to 12 people all trying to go towards the same goal, we get to collaborate and share a little more fluidly together.
It's funny about how you say you hire men from time to time, because this is reverse chauvinism and people are gonna get pissed off at me, but in my bookstore, I hire women. And the reason that I do is because every time I've hired a guy, it's been a big disappointment. The women come out from behind the counter. They ask you, are you browsing? Do you want this or that? And when there's nothing to do, there's always something to do. Right. And so they come out from the counter, they arrange the books so the spines are at the end of the shelves. They rearrange our retail stuff. They sweep, they clean the bathroom. Whereas the guys, they sit behind the counter and they just kind of like, they'll sit there with their, you know, this forever stare out, you know. And this sounds horrible, but.
Sorry, you cut out there for a minute, but I kind of get the gist of what you're saying. I just, I feel really lucky that I, you know, get to work with people based on their work, you know, and I know just as many men as I know women cooks who are eager and generous and have a great spirit and a great work ethic. And I feel real fortunate, and I quantify it because I think people so often think that, you know, that we're all out here just trying to create covens, which are great. I have, you know, I'm honored to be a, you know, to be is amongst very many strong, incredible women. And there are so many men out here that I really value the interaction with. And I think it's really exciting to be sort of transcending this idea of, you know, I've definitely had some women say to me, oh, well, just, you know, get money from women investors and women bankers. And I'm like, well, you know, the interesting thing is in the South, there's not a whole lot of female VCs floating around with billions of dollars to spend. And so it affords you this opportunity to really like diversify your community in that way. So, you know, everybody's doing the best they can, I hope.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I guess, in your Twitter feed, and because we're in COVID, and you talked a little bit about it, is your mom okay? Did she really have COVID, or?
My mom has been okay. My mom and I have, you know, been on a journey with this book, but she's healthy. She's well. They have not. Yeah,
maybe
sorry.
It was Maybe it was one of the tweets that was responding to your tweet, and I missed it that way. All right, never mind.
A dear friend of mine's mother has not been well with COVID, so maybe there were some.
That's probably what it was.
Yeah.
You know, and this part, before we move on, this part, I wouldn't say it other than the fact that you say it in your book, in that one line where you go, my alcohol-soaked liver and your anguished constipation. So I guess we should talk about that a little bit.
I mean, the restaurant industry is not, built for health. You know, you find yourself working these unfathomably long hours full of intensity. And, I think I thrive in some ways with that kind of work. I like fast-paced work. I'm built for it. I like working hard. I like... I don't, this quarantine has been a real eye opener for me. I've had to really work with myself with how to stay home and be still. And it's all for the best. Like, it's been a very good journey of like learning how to be still. But that has not been my nature most of my adult life. I'm very dynamic in all of the ways, and I don't even mean it necessarily as a compliment to myself. I just need to be moving all of the time, and so in some ways it really works. And then somewhere, you know, the train gets off the rails a little bit, and you realize that, you know, waking up at 6 a.m. to get your kids to school, packing their lunches. You know, have you ever seen the Goodfellas?
Yeah.
So, okay, it's my favorite movie in the whole wide world. Like, I could probably watch it 20 times a year. But that scene at the end where he's all coked out and he's got like sauce on the stove and he's got to go run the cocaine over here and he's got to go do that, felt like about 5 years of my life without the cocaine. Like, just felt like this sort of like I had 20 things going on at any given hour that I had to address. My phone was ringing off the hook, emails ringing off the hook. There's not a lot of time for eating, sleeping. I never drink any water. I would go all day without a sip of water. And then at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whenever I'd finish like running service at the restaurant or traveling or doing whatever, I'd drink a bunch of gin to go to sleep, you know, and like eat a bunch of carbohydrates, gain 20 pounds, go to bed with no water, but plenty of booze and plenty of carbohydrates. And my body was like, what's happening? All of my levels are going nuts, you know? And it's like, you realize you're breaking your body very quickly. And so, you know, part of my realization with how dysfunctional the restaurant industry was for me as a human was in part realizing how dysfunctional the restaurant industry was for my body, like as a physical machine that needed to do work. So, you know, you can't run a machine. There's so many analogies you could make about gumming up the works, and that's part of it. You know, chefs don't have a whole lot of time when they reach a certain part of their career and they're managing two kitchens in two different states and they've got staff, you know, here and there, and they're writing recipes and all, you know, all sorts of things. There's all sorts of things that all of a sudden are on your plate, and taking care of yourself is usually becomes the last one. So,
speaking of movies, did you ever see the movie Big Night by any chance?
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. That omelet, I mean, ask any chef what their favorite scene is, and it's the omelet scene of Big Night.
Yep. Yeah. But, it's like this brotherhood. It's like this ballet almost, you know?
Visually, as someone that is a total film nerd, visually, it's just one of the most beautifully shot movies I've ever, so sorry. That's I've right. ever seen. And, you know, the narrative of, for me, like the food narrative is also just really perfectly written. It's subtle, like they catch the subtlety of that sort of conversation about the richness and deepness of food and family. And then they also capture like the subtlety of why it's also really complicated, you know, and hard.
It's kind of like your book, because actually I thought of it when I was reading your book, because I thought of their restaurant and the woman who doesn't want the, what is this, when it was the risotto that he's slaved over and he's screaming in the kitchen. And then across the street, you have this restaurant that's so successful because it's just catering to the lowest. It's like when you go to Times Square and everyone's eating at Fridays, or that other guy who does Diners Dive, you know, that guy.
Yeah.
His restaurant. It's just, yeah, that's something you have to deal with too, I guess.
Well, you know, and again, not to keep putting so much pressure on this moment of, but I do feel like this moment is a real transitory moment where we get to sort of think about what we value as a culture. And I really hope that this is a moment that everyone realizes how important those kinds of restaurants, where it is a chef and it is his cooks and it is his, you know, it is his building, how much value those bring to not just like our communities, but to us as a human body, how rich of an experience that is for us to be able to walk into a space where there's a woman or a man standing behind a stove and they want to cook for you, instead of this conglomerate idea of, you know, five pages of a menu full of, you know, fancy things that don't matter and that are fine and they serve a purpose, I suppose. But also, I just feel there's a great hope in this moment. I want to believe there's a great hope in this moment that we can decide as an American culture that we want to protect these businesses over, you know, the businesses that are going to be fine, the ones that are getting all of the big PPP monies and all of the big, you know, federal government savings monies. And, you know, they were going to be fine to begin with because they've got, you know, or they were going to be better than some of these smaller places to begin with because they have these big lines of credit with big banks and everything. And meanwhile, the restaurants, to use Big Night as an example, where it's, you know, a very small team built on the sweat of their brow, built on the savings that they, you know, cobbled together themselves because they're dedicated to this idea of serving something sincere and beautiful and true to their community. I really think this is a moment for us to do our best to try to protect those places and say, as a country, this is what we value. It's a real good moment for that, you know. So I guess that's a political beseechment to like get out there and really try to help in your communities, find those places and see what they need, you know, support those places.
You know, I interviewed, it seems like forever ago, but actually it was during COVID. I interviewed this woman who wrote this book called Wine Girl about the youngest woman sommelier in the country. And there's so many parallels because being the youngest woman, she was like 23 or maybe younger, she was just treated horribly. By all of the men customers who just didn't believe that it was like that quote, you know, be invisible, don't take up any space, you're stupid. And she had to fight against that. The reason I thought about it was because during COVID, you know, they used that service, not Grubhub or DoorDash, but they used one called Caviar. I don't know if you've heard of that one. And it delivers in New York. And so they're doing that thing where she's delivering bottles of wine or even carafes of wine and then doing it twice in one night or mixed drinks and things like that. And the funny thing is, my brothers and I own, now I'm putting myself in that place, we own like four restaurants, and the sushi restaurant is actually doing better now than it was before all of this. Well, and especially now with outdoor seating, I don't know what's going to happen in the winter. But it is definitely a new paradigm. So what about you? I mean, there you are. And we talked about hand pies. Do you still? So let's start talking about food, because everyone who buys this book, there's a big part of them that's going to think, oh, there's going to be recipes throughout and I'm going to learn how to make things. And it's true to a certain extent, but what about the food? How did you start? Why did you end up in pastries? Especially that first part when you talk about how people don't want to be working with you at the end of the night or in the beginning of the night because pastries down like at the bottom level of everything.
That's a multifaceted answer. Yeah. That's okay. It's good. It's, I I think I was attracted to pastry and baking because I grew up in Europe, and I, you know, and then I moved to the South when I was 15, and there were so many parts of my childhood that I really missed. And I'll admit, I was probably even a little bit of a cultural snob when I got back to the States, because we moved to a small town in Georgia, and it was definitely devoid of anything like, you know, a good loaf of bread or whatever. So I'm sure I had a little cultural chip on my shoulder about, you know, the bunny bread that was the only thing the grocery store carried. And it was 1992, and, you know, the how far removed the South was from having any conversations about food. You know, being a vegetarian was outrageous in 1992 in North Georgia, which is I was, and that's where I was. And so I started cooking and I started baking. And then as I got older, I just really started understanding that my brain really loved the technical aspect of working with food and learning how to, you know, build, you know, something out of literally just flour and water and the different evolutions that could take. I initially started by baking bread, and that was my first true passion. I really, really thought, you know, if you had asked me at 18 or 19 or 20, you know, what I wanted to do was to open a bakery. You know, I want in a bread bakery solely, like an old time French bread bakery that just was a big oven where you're just churning out bread. And I was so obsessed with the idea of that, and being a part of a community in that way, it would really appeal to me. And then, you know, life happens and you have a kid, and all of a sudden you're cooking for your kid and your kids and your husband, and you're trying to make a living. And I knew also early on that I really wanted to incorporate writing. I had been a writer, you know. It sounds cheesy, but I think people are, you know, either born a writer or not typically, you know, and I had written my whole life, and I really had this urge to write. And so I knew that I could find my way. You know, the thing that didn't scare me about food, committing myself to food, was that I knew I could also write. There was an aspect of food that would still allow me to write. And so I didn't feel like I was having to leave one for the other, which was really appealing to me because I'm very noncommittal. And so I decided, well, I'm going to go down this road. And I really embraced the work of baking and loved it. And it was really special to me. And I was able to make a living in my community and then eventually work in restaurants. And then I was able to write. And, you know, and I think, you know, for me, the hand pies were such a really big moment, because I worked really hard to sort of combine this French technique that I had spent all of my younger years teaching myself with this idea of what Southern baking is and what Southern pastry is. And so combining the two became like a real special sort of pet project for me, because you can take something, and I hate the word elevate because it implies that it's not good to begin with, but just if you know taking something like a pie or a hand pie and using French technique to sort of create the fruit and the pie dough and the shell, all of a sudden you get something that's like still really comforting, which is really important to me, and really accessible and really familiar with something that is really structurally locked down. So once I nailed it, it hasn't changed in about 5 years. So that's good.
Yeah. And that was first, I'm trying to look up the spot. Let me see if I can find it. You know, in the very beginning, it's Costa Rica, right? That's where you were, Costa Rica. Uh-huh. Yeah. The fruit, the way you describe the fruit there, it's so sensory and so succulent. It just, you could see it.
There's nothing like.
Yeah, it makes such a difference, and people don't really think about that, but you think about it a lot.
I think about it all the time, and I think, you know, it's funny, in the South, you get so used to the rhythms of our season here, and we're very fortunate to have really beautiful fruit seasons, but we still have seasons nonetheless, and And there are some fruits that don't do so well here. And I talk about it a little bit as far as the apricots in California go. And I thought apricots were just a terrible fruit for the longest time because I'd never been to California. And then you go to California and you realize that likely apricot is the most luxurious, glorious fruit on the planet. But, you know, you have to be in the right place at the right time. And apparently in California, it's always the right time for amazing fruit. Which seems like, you know, a total unfair advantage all of the chefs have out there. They literally, you know, literally they just put it on a plate for you. We have to do a little bit more work down here in the South. We get, you know, really beautiful peaches, and then we get our Louisiana strawberries around February, and we get our Louisiana citrus in the winter, which is always really remarkable. And, you know, we get our own fruit seasons, but, you know, you have to be. And when I was in Costa Rica, I think Costa Rica is similar to California. It's never not great. The mangoes there are always going to be beautiful and perfect, you know.
Yeah, the way
it seems.
The way you competed with the monkeys, and it was like monkeys, yeah. 10, you won. That was. So I don't know if it's, you know, this is the kind of question everybody gives in an interview, like if you were interviewed by Terry Gross or something, but. And also, are any of these people we would know? Do you have any like idols? Did you follow somebody? Were there some people that were just, you know, you were like standing on the shoulders of giants kind of thing?
Oh yeah, I mean, I early on was obsessed with Pierre Hermé, who is a French pastry chef, and then by way of Pierre Hermé, I found Dory Greenspan, and everyone knows Dory Greenspan in the United States, or should. And Dory Greenspan became someone that I felt was just so, you know, she used to write other people's cookbooks. That's how she got started. She wrote Baking with Julia about Julia Child. She wrote Pierre Hermé's books. Yeah, she's brilliant. And then she started to write her own. And I could have that wrong. She might have had her own cookbook initially, but I found her by way of Pierre Hermé and Julia Child, and then became obsessed with her accessibility and the way she talks about baking, because I think baking and pastry become such an intimidating space for so many people. And Dory does a really great job of talking about ingredients and talking about, you know, she understands how to communicate a recipe. And that became a language I really wanted to learn. And I learned it by watching Dory Greenspan, who now, you know, I can call like a peer. I would never call her a peer. I take it back. She's, you know, she's a supernova in the scheme of things. But, you know, I get to have a friendship with her now, and I get to, you know, I get to connect with her as a baker in the real world. So that's been a really important relationship. I think, you know, Diana Kennedy has always been a major inspiration because she was having conversations, and I know that there's some conversations about appropriation, and, you know, she's an English woman, but I think her story, I shouldn't say but, that's important, and I think it's also really important to talk about who she was in the context of the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and how she, you know, the way in which she gained access to these stories in, you know, Central America, and how she discovered these great conversations about food and how dedicated she has been to that in her life. And she's just this, like, you know, incredible, incredible human being that has such a gift of seeing the value in other people. And I really appreciate how she does that. And so she's another one that I just will admire for the rest of my life. I think she's a magical, magical creature. And I can't believe I've been able to cook for her and spend even half a, you know, even the cumulative 30 minutes over a weekend that I got to spend with her. It will be a treasure for me for the rest of my life.
Hey, thinking about all that, I was wondering, do chefs steal from one another like comedians do? Like they steal each other's jokes?
Well, I don't think we think of it that way. I think, you know, there are two conversations that can be had here. Like, does anyone own a recipe, and or how do people get compensated for their recipes? But I think that's a different conversation. I think the bigger picture of cooks is that we typically like to work in concert with each other and in community with each other. And I think that's really particular of the South. I can't speak for other regions, but I can tell you that Southern chefs are a little bit of a different breed than other regions in the country. And I'm saying that based on what other chefs in other regions have said to me about how do you guys all can't be best friends. This has got to be a joke. You guys are, it's bullshit. And I'm like, no, actually, we all actually are really close. And, you know, I have shared my recipes with chefs in pastry chefs in Raleigh, North Carolina, that he would put on his menu and he would even call it what I called it. And, you know, chefs in New Orleans, we trade recipes and we talk about technique and we talk about ideas, because at the end of the day, I can give you my recipe, but it's going to be the way you made it. It's not going to be the way I made it.
No, that's definitely true.
And I know what I do, and I don't leave anything out. I'm not one of those like greedy recipe givers that leaves that one, you know, ingredient so that it's not the same as mine. I'll give you the whole thing. I'll try to communicate it the best I can, but at the end of the day, you're still going to do it differently than I do it. You're going to have different products. And I think there's a spirit of collaboration that, again, I'll say Southern chefs really thrive on. And many of my recipes are in other people's restaurants, you know, so, and I think that's true of everyone's recipes. I don't know how many times I don't eat a lot of meat. So whenever I never cooked meat in a restaurant, but when I need to, I, you know, call people I know that cook meat all the time and they give me their recipes. And those are now my habits, but I'll always think like, oh, no. Jason Stanhope gave me that for that, whatever. And, it's not written down on my card or anything that it's his whatever, his chicken.
Well, so, okay. So to conclude, and you know, for 5 months now, my bookstore has been in a kind of limbo. We've opened up partially now and actually we're doing well. But so you're in the same situation, and I hate the expression, the new normal, but you're going to come out of this. So what's your future? Do you have you made plans during this time that you're sticking at home, or have you done things like me and just sat on your ass? That's what I've done.
I mean, I've got two kids. I think a lot about them in the context of this time. My son is 20 and he's in college, and my daughter's soon to be 16 and she's a junior in high school. And so I think a lot about their future. I think of course about our future, my husband and my future, but you know, I think a lot about what this looks like for them and how this, you know, how we get them through this phase to, you know, what does the world look like for them? I mean, I can't imagine being 20 in this moment in time. Can you? I mean, I've got so much of my own things that I was already, you know, when you're 20, you're already dealing with crippling self-doubt and uncertainty about things. And what are you supposed to do? And how are you supposed to do it? And will it ever come to fruition for you? And then to add all of this to it, I can't imagine. So, you know, a lot of my like heart is with sort of what is going to happen for them in the next 10 years, and what's going to happen in the country in the next 10 years. You know, I feel really, really fortunate in this moment to be, you know, I have been writing a whole lot, which is what I said I always wanted to be doing. And this has sort of forced my hand and like, well, you know, you're not cooking for anybody right now, and you won't be cooking for anyone for right now. And maybe this is the moment where you get to decide that your financial insecurities that will always linger can be quieted a little bit, and you can just work on writing. And, you know, I've been sort of juggling and keeping cooking close to me because I know I can always make a buck cooking, right? You know, I can make anything and cook it and sell it, and I will be okay. And this feels like a real truth moment for me of saying, okay, well, you're not cooking for anybody, so go make a living writing. This is what you say. And you know, I have a book that just came out, so there's even more sort of impetus to be dedicated to this as a whole. And that's my hope anyway. You know, my hope anyway is that I get to move out of this moment and just keep writing and having time with my family and
The book is so, in a way, cinematic. maybe you'll get optioned by for a Netflix series or Hulu or a cooking show, because it seems like that's what I would think. I mean, it was cinematic to me because you could see yourself as a character and all the other people you bring in. So, you know, who knows?
That's nice to hear. That's very nice to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thanks a lot for being here, taking time. I enjoyed the thunderstorm.
Thanks. I could hear it. It was really, that was also very cinematic. You should have seen it.
Yeah, it was cool. Especially, it happened when you were talking about your Nana, too. So I thought, oh, well.
Told you.
So we've been talking with Lisa Donovan. Her book is Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. It's a memoir and published by Penguin Press. No better press than that. So thanks again, Lisa. It was a pleasure talking to you.
So nice to be here with you.
Talk to you soon.
Take care.
You too.